This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, we're going to be talking about the labor movement in America and the progressive movement. And with me to discuss this issue is Amy Dean, longtime labor activist with AFL-CIO and founder of two nonprofit groups, Working Partnerships USA and Building Partnerships USA. She's the co-author with David Reynolds of a recent book called A New New Deal: How Regional Activism Will Reshape the American Labor Movement. Amy Dean, welcome to Progressive Radio.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
How'd you get interested in the labor movement?
From an early age. My grandparents came to this country like many immigrants, bags packed with few possessions, overflowing with social vision, built the precursors to unions, mutual aid societies. And so they modeled for me what it meant to care for one another. And then later on in life, as I became a student at the University of Illinois, I sort of acquired the intellectual underpinnings for what was already in my heart. And even though in the 1980s, the labor movement was not the place where you wanted to be as a young person, it was something that was a calling for me.
So when you graduated from college, you decided to go straight into the labor movement?
I wanted to work for the labor movement, yes. And I saw it, in spite of it being in a period of decline and entrenchment and being attacked at that time by the Reagan administration, I really saw it as an important institution that, because of its national reach and the infrastructure that reached out to 50 states and 600 communities across the country, that it really had the capacity to make broad-scale, sweeping reforms and change in a way that more local community-based organizations or more fragmented movements could not.
And yet you've done a lot of local work or regional work since then. And it started, I'm gathering from your book, A New New Deal, it started with Harold Washington's Chicago.
It did. I was a young person working for the Ladies Garment Workers Union, and at the time, Harold Washington was the mayor of Chicago. And it was a terribly exciting moment because he demonstrated that government could be more than a spectator sitting on the sidelines of economic growth, and that it had a direct role to play in fashioning the economy and determining whether it was an economy that met the needs of working people or not. And he partnered with labor unions and industry leaders to say, we can retain jobs in the textile and apparel industry, we can retain jobs in the steel industry, and we can really hold on to our manufacturing base in our city if we use the tools of government and the role of labor-based organizations to attract and retain industry.
Harold Washington got elected and was a popular mayor because of this kind of community coalition building that he developed and those around him developed. Is that where you got some of that appreciation?
What I didn't know at the time, because I was too young, but that the economic development strategies that he pursued, for example, we can invest in small businesses and help them grow successors. We can invest in small businesses and offer certain kinds of tax incentives and financing for these companies to stay in the long haul. What I didn't understand at the time, which I think now many of us do, that the way he used local government and local financing to hold on to jobs that allowed people to enter into the economic mainstream of community was some of the most progressive stuff we ever saw and have seen since.
Hmm. What were you doing with the garment workers?
Well, it's an interesting story. I started out as an organizer. And early on in my tenure, there was a task force that the mayor put together. It was a task force to retain and attract textile and apparel jobs at a time where most cities had written off that industry. And I got sent to participate in this task force and to come up with strategies for holding on to these jobs. And what I realized that when I sat around the table and saw my counterparts, which were all heads of their organizations, and I was sort of this low-level organizer for the union, I understood that the union did not really see this task force as important to its self-interests. And so what was interesting for me as I started out as an organizer is that immediately, early on, I recognized two things. One, that labor has a broader role to play as the steward of working people that goes beyond the workplace. And two, when it does play that role, it can have enormous impact on quality of life for both its members and the broader community of working people. But what I discovered at that time, last thing I'll say, is that our union didn't understand that. And that's why I got sent to be on that task force. Not because I was some smart person, but because it was not important to the local.
And when did you leave the garment workers then?
So I worked for the Ladies Garment Workers Union for 5 years, and that brought me to California to their San Francisco office. And then shortly thereafter, decided that I wanted to work for the broader Federation of Labor, the AFL-CIO, in large part because what I witnessed in Chicago is that labor, when it acts as a community-based organization, can have a much bigger impact on the conditions of working people versus just simply limiting its role to the workplace. And so the notion of working for this geographic-based labor federation that sort of sits at the crossroads between labor and community was very attractive to me, and that's when I went to go work for the AFL-CIO in Silicon Valley.
And this was at the time when Silicon Valley was really booming.
What I got to observe and witness in the decade and a half that I lived there is I watched the economy go through three major revolutions. It was an amazing time to be there, and it's still an amazing place. But I think what's most important about the region that oftentimes people miss in terms of the story, that what makes Silicon Valley interesting or important for the country is not necessarily the products and the technology that's coming out of Silicon Valley, but the work systems and the way in which industry organizes itself, and last, the extent to which local infrastructure, transportation systems, land use policies, affordable housing stock, quality of life, higher educational systems, that these infrastructures are very important to the success of industry. And so this is what is interesting about Silicon Valley, the work systems and the infrastructure these kinds of industries depend upon for their success.
I'm speaking with Amy Dean. She's the co-author of a new book called A New New Deal, How Regional Activism Will Reshape the American Labor Movement. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, and this is Progressive Radio. So you're there in Silicon Valley. I read that you were called the most powerful woman in San Jose. What's that about? How'd you get such a title?
I'm not sure. You know, our labor federation made a decision early on that if we were going to simply limit our role to collective bargaining and only show up in the halls of government and in the public square when town hall, when a collective bargaining interest was at stake, then we would continue to be very marginal players in the larger regional economic development discussion and policy making. And so early on, we made the decision that we will not allow the broader community to define when we have particular interests, but rather we will define a much broader agenda for labor and our partners in the community and take on all the economic development issues that impact working people. And so I think the posture that we took, the policy programs that we advanced, the partners that we brought together, the way in which we advanced that into the political arena meant that our local labor federation began to enjoy a lot of influence that led to very good things for working people. I don't know that that was about me personally, but we became a very powerful and influential force in ways that you don't think about when you think of the labor movement.
Well, what were some of those ways, or what were some of those expansive issues?
Great question. We developed an entire policy framework around transportation, around land use, around affordable housing. We said that these are issues that every day of the week local government makes. They make decisions all around what kinds of monies get invested to attract and retain what kinds of jobs. They make decisions about what transportation systems get funded. They make decisions about what the definition of affordable housing is. And all of those things matter to working people. And if labor is really exercising its role as a steward on behalf of working people, then it needs to engage in these kinds of questions. And we built a very sophisticated policy capacity to allow us to understand tax increment financing, to understand the mechanisms of local and regional government that we could get our arms around to yield more of a popular agenda for working people. And I think people don't expect the labor movement to operate that way. They don't think of us as being smart. And at the core of that, the core of what we did was we said, when we elected people to office, when they came before us for endorsements, we said, we have an expectation that we want to create early on with you. We aren't here simply to do the heavy lifting. We are not just here to put up the lawn signs and make the phone calls and go door to door, but we expect to also be part of doing the heavy thinking. And we've built a policy and research capacity that allows you to have more capacity than the 1.2 staff people that you would normally have when you get elected. And we expect to be part of your governing coalition as much as we are a part of your electoral one.
And were you getting resistance from upper echelons of the union movement? You know, maybe you guys should just deal with your members and not deal with these broader issues?
That's a great question. And one of the things that whenever you take on the work that we describe in a New Deal, which is we call regional power building, we talk about the ways in which labor in coalition with community is transforming its role in regional government. One of the things that it takes is that you always have to build consensus among your own institution. And so we went through a process early on with our executive board where we asked ourselves, how do we want to be seen 5 to 7 years down the road by our members, by all working people, by elected officials, by the press, by the business community? And we said we wanted to be seen as smart, effective, and credible. And we said, if we want to be seen as those things, then we need to build a set of capacities that we don't have, and we need to function differently. And so everything is a process in terms of moving people in a different direction, and all of that happens at the local level. And the thing that I will tell you is that the labor leaders in our region were no different than labor leaders across the country. And so if it can be done in one part of the country, it can really be done anywhere. So absolutely, moving labor to think differently was a big part of the sort of foundational work that we did to build our own regional power base in Silicon Valley.
I'm speaking with Amy Dean, who did some incredible path-breaking organizing in Silicon Valley. She's the co-author of a new book called A New Deal, How Regional Activism Will Reshape the American Labor Movement. Part of the coalition building the community labor alliances that you describe in this book have to deal with labor making alliances with immigrant groups, with minority groups, with faith-based groups. How crucial are those?
Very crucial. If we're going to be the majority again, in other words, if we're going to have a progressive agenda in America, and we can discuss what does that mean, then we can't limit ourselves to those who are already participating in the electoral arena. We have to be able to engage a broader cross-section of who's involved. And so making alliances with the immigrant community and building a partnership in the electoral arena by expanding who participates is foundational to being able to win. At least for us, we were focused on the city and county level. But without being able to stitch together sort of a white working class immigrant and of color alliance in community districts, we could never have won the majority of seats in the city council. So when they referred to labor as being one of the most powerful institutions in Santa Clara Valley, it's because we stitched together a political basis for unity between those two parts of the electorate.
And how hard was that? What kind of an obstacle was racism? Not that racism is endemic to the working class, not part of the middle or upper class, but was that a hurdle?
Well, I think the way we bridged the gap, the actual tools that we created to build alliances were three important tools, and I'll try to run through them quickly. It's very substantive, but I don't want to spend too much. I want to be able to give enough content and yet not spend the last 20 minutes on this, but three really important tools that we used to build alliances. First and foremost, we created something where we took a page out of the business community, and we created something called the Labor Community Leadership Institute, a 9-week program that brought together leaders, activists from different organizations to study the economy and to develop a shared understanding of the economy and, more importantly, a shared understanding of what are the political levers that we can exercise or move to shift the economy in our direction. In other words, how can we use zoning policies? How can we use prevailing wage and living wage policies? How can we use different public policies to impact the economy and recognize together that the economy isn't influenced by physical laws of nature? So we used a leadership institute and continue to use it to this day to cultivate relationships and a shared social vision. The second thing is that having a policy capacity and being able to advance your own policy initiatives allow you to build up front meeting the needs and interests of the groups you're trying to work with. So when you are able to develop housing policy, for example, rather than wait for the city to propose policy and then you come in and oppose or defend parts of it, and you get into this debate where if we build it with the prevailing wage, then it can't really be affordable. If you can propose affordable housing that does both, then automatically your ability to propose policy can knit and stitch together the interests of the very groups you want to hold together. And the last piece, most importantly, this we talk about the Labor Community Leadership Institute, the policy capacity. And the last piece was our ability to do research, popular research, where we, in collaboration with a broad cross-section of the economy, of the community, said, what are the kinds of things we want to understand better collectively? What is it we want to understand about the quality of employment that's being created and how that doesn't meet our needs? What are the other kinds of things we want to understand collectively? And so through stitching together these important pieces, these were very important in our community and in other cases where we do case studies in the book. These particular capacities allowed us to be on the offense and to be mindful of the groups we wanted to keep together, as opposed to being on the defense, where we begin to fight against each other, and then the victories become very zero-sum and very small.
Hmm. I'm speaking with Amy Dean here in the book she just made reference to is A New Deal, How Regional Activism Will Reshape the American Labor Movement, which she co-wrote with David Reynolds. What is that New Deal? What is the shared social vision that you are alluding to?
Well, I think that if we want to once again have an economy that looks more like the fat man at the circus versus the hourglass that we have today, and we once again want to have a robust middle class, not to be romantic about the days of the past, but it certainly is better than where we find ourselves today.
Romantic about the fat man at the circus, though. There's an image for you.
So, you know, if we want to get back to the days where it does look more like the fat man at the circus with a robust middle, then the labor movement must be revitalized. And I would argue that we can't have a progressive movement in America absent a revitalized labor movement.
Could you flesh that out? Because I saw that in the book itself, how vital the labor movement is to progressive social change.
I think we can certainly imagine with terror that we could have a trade union movement absent a progressive movement. And that's something that I think none of us feel comfortable with. But I'm not certain that we can have a broader progressive movement, a sort of left-wing flank that moves our president in the direction that we want to move without the labor movement, given that it's the largest membership-based organization. It's the only thing that comes close to spending the amounts of money that corporate America spends on elections and campaigns. It's the only thing that's got the resources and the base that comes close to being able to contest for power. Now, that's not to say that we can do it on our own. But if you talk to progressives across America, nobody's really clear about why is collective bargaining and the role of unions important. And there are really but two ways to lift people out of poverty. One is to create public standards of employment, and the other is to give people the rights to bargain collectively. I would argue that in the absence of having a restoration of the rights to bargain collectively here in America, and to then extend those rights as a condition of our trade agreements, to extend that value into our trade agreements, that there is no other way to ensure that the economy and global capital is not just a race to the bottom. And there really isn't anything that can, to scale, challenge the free reign of capital. Now, that's not to say that we're doing it. It's not to say that we can do it on our own. But I don't see a progressive movement in America with an eviscerated labor movement. Mm.
Do you see the progressive movement in America ignoring the labor movement?
You know, I think that you know, one of the things that John Sweeney should be remembered for was that he opened up the tent again, and that as a labor movement reached out again for the first time. And I think he put in place, a process for making the labor movement be reach back out to partners of the past. And there's still so much to be done. I think that in the progressive movement, people really don't understand the labor movement. We don't do a good job of explaining it. We're not always the best partners at the table. But having said all of that, I think that there have to be more people and leaders and institutions that bridge those two worlds, because we absolutely need each other.
Amy Dean, explain your opinion about the split that happened. The AFL changed to win split, and all that internal stuff seemed to be mind-boggling to a lot of outsiders.
Yeah, I think when people look from the outside in, they tend to see a lot of internecine battles that don't seem like they're growing out of ideological differences, but it's much more infighting, and in many cases it is. But I would say that the split probably caused more people to look at the labor movement, pay attention to the labor movement, and wonder what was going on. And, you know, my short take on that is that a split took place. But yet very few people outside of Washington really noticed. And what I mean by that is local and state labor movements stayed together in spite of the split, which suggests that people's needs are being met. So long and short was we had a fight in 2005 at the national level, and I'm not sure people at the local level seem to really know the difference. And that's because people working together further away from Washington tend to build solidarity. And that's the case that our book makes. Our book makes the case that the regional innovation that's growing out of labor community collaboratives, winning some very exciting kinds of policy victories and political victories, will pave the road for a different kind of labor movement tomorrow. And the further we do get away from the entrenchment of national politics and national institutions, there is more political space and will to innovate, to partner, and to create lots of different kinds of victories that we highlight in the book.
Yeah, you talk about these regional victories and these regional structures and strategies, Amy Dean, in your book, A New New Deal, How Regional Activism Will Reshape the American Labor Movement. You talk about the importance of federations at the county level. At least that's what we have here, or the South Central Federation in Wisconsin, which is where I'm at, and also some central labor councils. And so why is that a good place to start?
Well, these councils that you refer to are the regional federation, so the collection of all the local unions in the community come together under the federation. The local, it's either called the local central body or the regional AFL-CIO, lots of different names, but they're essentially organizations that sit at the crossroads between labor and community, and that they represent the collective interests of unions. And they're an interesting organization. They represent the political interests of people somewhere in between a neighborhood and a state. When people say, what's a region? When you say, well, it's something bigger than a neighborhood and smaller than a state. It may not perfectly coextend to political boundaries, but there are economic boundaries that define a region. And these federated bodies are very interesting because they bring together such a broad cross-section of the community. They bring together everything from bus drivers to iron workers to nurses to teachers and everything in between. The only thing that has that broad a reach is probably the church. And so the ability to really mobilize a mass base exists at the level of these organizations. And so there's over 600 of them across the country. And they grew up as an important institution to provide mutual aid and support to people when they were on strike, or you were far away from your international and you needed support from your local community and you didn't really know how you could relate to your international. And these local bodies were gutted in the 1930s. Through changes in the national AFL-CIO bylaws, their influence and power was gutted with the rise of international unions that rose in response to big industrial restructuring. And so these organizations were seen as a threat to the national power base. And they have enormous potential. And the case studies that we identify in our book in California and Atlanta and Denver and Boston and Connecticut and other places around the country, you see these local regional bodies of labor teaming up with community to pass things like children's health insurance, to pass things like affordable housing initiatives that are broad and sweeping, to pass policies that make transportation accessible to the people who really need it. All sorts of regional economic development policies that could be a very different outcome and meet the needs of very different people. And so these regional federations of labor are very important for making regional change. And the last thing I'll say is this. If labor is to renew its fortunes in America and to become the social force it once was, then it must become not only a workplace-based organization, but it must become a community-based one too. And these regional bodies do really represent labor in the community as opposed to local unions that represent labor in the workplace.
Hmm. Amy Dean, I've wondered for a long time about the AFL strategy in electoral politics, whether they're spending too much on races and what is the opportunity cost of that. If they spent the $30 million every 4 years or every 2 years to hire an organizer, you could hire a lot of organizers for that. And I just wonder what the long-term strategy is there.
Well, the question sort of answers the problem, which is we have to have another way of measuring our success or lack thereof every election cycle. And, you know, one of the things that I often say when I'm speaking public about Labor's electoral strategy is that I make the analogy to parenting. And that as a parent, one of the things that you learned is that if something doesn't work with your child, don't do more of it. And what does that mean for electoral politics and the labor movement? It means that I have to ask the question for people who are listening today, how many people really think that if we had three more seats in the Senate and a bigger majority in the Congress, that that would substantially alter the outcome of the kinds of public policies that we get in this country? And I would have to argue that many of us feel not much difference. So we can't give up on the national front, but what I would argue is that the over $100 million that we spend every election cycle, and sometimes even more, that a fraction of that ought to go into building local infrastructure. Because we know that parachuting people in from all over the country to, you know, do a short-term effort around electoral politics does not only not build our local capacity to build the kinds of organizations that we talk about in our book, but it depletes our capacity. So we have to have a measure the outcome of our electoral efforts with a dual bottom line. One, did we win or not? And two, what got left behind? Did we build more infrastructure or did we deplete it? 2004, Labor and the Democratic Party was never more organized in terms of its field operation than ever before. And yet we got killed in neighborhoods. Why? Well, someone gets parachuted in from a college campus that doesn't even have the same accent and is talking about our candidate versus a neighbor shows up and is talking about their candidate. It's about the messenger. And people, the world is relational. And some college student comes in to talk about a candidate versus my neighbor comes in to talk about a candidate, it doesn't almost matter who the candidate is. It matters who's the messenger. And so if we're not building our own leadership in neighborhoods and rebuilding civic infrastructure in our communities, we will not rebuild progressive politics in America. It's this simple. Message and communication in and of itself will not bring about the politics that we want in this country. It will not bring about a more just, compassionate, and fair America. Building our own regional infrastructure and rebuilding the front lines of America, which there's no short-term way to do that, is what will rebuild our ability to really contest for power again. Last point. The right wing understands this. And after the Goldwater defeat, they said to themselves back in the 60s, message and communication is not enough. We have to have local infrastructure. The problem is that when we look back in the right, we're very selective on the left of looking at what works and what we need to rebuild. And these guys took a page out of our playbook. They said, these guys know how to organize in the community. And that's what they went about building. These Tea Party people running around the country, it's not simply organic frustration. If there wasn't already, you know, infrastructure in neighborhoods to build off of, they wouldn't be as effective as they're being in terms of getting their message out. So, you know, yes, it's important to have the message and a communication structure for getting it out. But if that's what we're going to hitch our success to, we will be off in the wilderness for a very, very long, long time.
Amy Dean has been my guest today on Progressive Radio. Thanks so much for being here. She is the author of A New Deal, How Regional Activism Will Reshape the American Labor Movement. She's an innovative and visionary labor leader, and I hope that message takes hold. Thanks a lot, Amy.
Thanks. My pleasure to be here.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.